How to draw a picture. 11. Don't quit until the picture's complete. I can't tell you if that's the cardinal rule of art or not. I'm no teacher, but I believe those six words sum up all I've been trying to tell you. Talent is a wonderful thing, but it won't carry a quitter. And there always comes a time, if the work is sincere, if it comes from that magic place where thought, memory, and emotion all merge, where you will want to quit. When you will think that if you put your pencil down, your eye will dull, your memory will lapse, and the pain will end. I know all this from the last picture I drew that day, the one of the gathering on the beach. It was only a sketch, but I think that when you're mapping hell, a sketch is all you need. I started with Adriana. All day long she had been frantic about M, her emotions ranging from wild anger at him to fear for him. It has even crossed her mind that Daddy has done something rash, although that seems unlikely. His grief has made him torpid and unresponsive ever since the search ended. When sunset comes and there's still no sign of M, you'd think she'd become more nervous than ever, but instead she grows calm, almost cheerful. She tells Nan Melda that M will be back directly, she's sure of it. She feels it in her bones and hears it in her head where it sounds like a small chiming bell. She supposes that bell is what they mean by woman's intuition, and you don't become fully aware of it until you're married. She tells Nanny this, too. Nan Melda nods and smiles, but she watches Addie narrowly. She's been watching her all day. The girl's man is gone for good. Libet has told her this, and Melda believes her. But Melda also believes that the rest of the family may be saved, that she herself may be saved. Much, however, depends on Libet herself. Nan Melda goes up to check on her remaining Babian, touching the bracelets on her left arm as she climbs the stairs. The silver bracelets are from her mama, and Melda wears them to church every Sunday. Perhaps that's why she took them from her special things box today, slipping them on and pushing them up until they stuck on the swell of her forearm, instead of letting them dangle loose above her wrist. Perhaps she wanted to feel a little closer to her mama, to borrow a little of Mama's quiet strength, or perhaps she just wanted the association of something holy. Libet is in her room drawing. She is drawing her family, Tessie and Lolo very much included. The eight of them, Nan Melda is also family as far as Libet is concerned, stand on the beach where they have spent so many happy times swimming and picnicking and building sandcastles, their hands linked like paper dolls, and great big smiles running off the sides of their faces. It's as if she thinks she can draw them back to life and happiness by the pure force of her will. Nan Melda could almost believe it possible. The child is powerful. Recreating life, however, is beyond her. Recreating life is even beyond the thing from the Gulf. Nan Melda's eyes drift to Libet's special things box before going back to Libet herself again. She has only seen the figurine that came from the Gulf once, a tiny woman in a faded pink wrap that might once have been scarlet, and a hood from which hair spills, hiding her brow. She asks Libet if everything is all right. It's all she dares to say, as far as she dares to go. If there really is a third eye hidden under the curls of the thing in the box, a far-seeing mojo eye, it is impossible to be too careful. Libet says, "Good. I just draw on Nan Melda." Has she forgotten what she's supposed to do? Nan Melda can only hope she hasn't. She has to go back downstairs now and keep an eye on Addie. Her man will be calling for her soon. Part of her cannot believe this is happening. Part of her feels as if her whole life has been a preparation for it. Melda says, "You may hear me call your daddy. If I do, you want to go pick up those things you left by the pool. Don't leave them out all night for the dew to get at." Still drawing, not looking up. But then she says something that gladdens Melda's frightened heart. "No'm. I'll take Percy. Then I won't be scared if it's dark." Melda says, "You take whoever you want, just bring in Noveen. She's still out there." It's all she has time for, all she dares when she thinks about that special probing mojo eye and how it might be trying to see inside her head. Melda touches her bracelets again as she goes downstairs. She is very glad she had them on while she was in Libet's room, even though the little China woman was put away in the tin box. She's just in time to see the swirl of Addie's dress at the end of the back hall as Addie turns into the kitchen. It is time. This is going to play out. Instead of following Addie into the kitchen, Melda runs down the front hall to the mister's study where, for the first time in the 7 years she's worked for the family, she enters without knocking. The mister is sitting behind his desk with his tie off and his collar undone and his braces hanging down in slack loops. He has the folding gold-framed pictures of Tessie and Lolo in his hands. He looks up at her, his eyes red in a face that is already thinner. He doesn't seem surprised that his housekeeper should come bursting in unannounced. He has the air of a man beyond surprise, beyond shock. But of course this will turn out not to be so. He says, "What is it, Melda Lou?" She says, "You got to come right away." He looks at her from his streaming eyes with a calm and infuriating stupidity. "Come where?" She says, "To the beach and bring that there." She points to the harpoon pistol, which hangs on the wall along with several short harpoons. The tips are steel, not silver, and the shafts are heavy. She knows. Hasn't she carried them in the basket enough times? He says, "What are you talking about?" She says, "I can't be taking time to explain. You got to come to the beach right now, lest you want to lose another one." He goes. He doesn't ask which daughter or inquire again why he should want the harpoon pistol. He just snatches it off the wall, takes two of the harpoons in his other hand, and strides out through the open study door, first beside Melda and then ahead of her. By the time he reaches the kitchen, where Melda has last seen Addie, he's at a full-out run, and she is falling behind even though she's running herself, holding her skirts before her in both hands. And is she surprised by this sudden break in his torpor? This sudden galvanizing action? No. Because despite the blanket of his grief, the mister has also known that something here is wrong, and going wronger all the time. The back door stands open. An evening breeze frisks in, stirring it back even farther on its hinges. Only now it's actually a night breeze. Sunset is dying. There will still be light on Shade Beach, but here at Heron's Roost, dark has already come. Melda dashes across the back porch and sees the mister already on the path to the beach. He's only a shadow. She looks around for Libet, but of course she doesn't see her. If Libet is doing what she is supposed to be doing, then she is already on her way to the swimming pool with her heart box under her arm. The heart box with the monster inside it. She runs after the mister and catches him at the bench where the path drops down to the beach. He is standing there frozen. In the west, the last of the sunset is a sullen orange line that will soon be gone, but there is enough light for her to see Addie at the edge of the water, and the man who is waiting to greet her. Adriana screams, "Emery!" She sounds mad with joy as if he's been gone a year instead of a day. Melda shouts, "No, Addie, keep away from him!" from beside the frozen, gaping man, but she knows Addie will pay no attention, and she doesn't. Addie runs to her husband. John Eastlake says, "What?" And that's all. He's broken free of his torpor long enough to run this far, but now he's frozen again. Is it because he sees the two other forms, farther out but also wading toward shore, wading in water that should be over their heads? Melda thinks not. She thinks he is still staring at his oldest daughter as the dim figure of the man coming out of the water reaches for her with his dripping arms and lays hold of her neck with his dripping hands, first choking off her glad cries and then dragging her into the surge. Out there in the gulf, waiting, ticking back and forth on the mild swell like a clock that tells time in years and centuries, rather than minutes and hours, is the black hulk of Percy's ship. Melda grabs the mister's arm, sinking her hand deep into the bicep, and speaks to him as she has never spoken to a white man in her life. She says, "Give her help, you son of a bitch, for he drowns her." She yanks him forward. He comes. She doesn't wait to see if he keeps on or freezes up again, and she's forgotten all about Libet. All she can think about is Addie. She has to stop the Emery thing from dragging her into the water, and she has to do it before the dead Babians can get there to help him. She cries, "Turn loose! Turn loose of her!" Flying down the beach with her skirt belling out behind, Emery has got Addie in almost up to her waist. Addie is now fighting, but she's also choking. Melda flounders toward them and throws herself on the pallid corpse who has his wife by the throat. He screams when Melda's left arm, the one with the bracelets on it, touches him. It is a bubbling sound, as if His throat is full of water. He writhes in Melda's grip like a fish, and she rakes him with her fingernails. Flesh sloughs away beneath them with sickening ease, but no blood flows from the pale wounds. His eyes roll in their sockets, and they are like the eyes of a dead carp in the moonlight. He pushes Adriana away so he can grapple with the harpy that has attacked him, the harpy with the cold, repelling fire on its arm. Addie wails, "No, Nanny, stop! You're hurting him!" Addie flounders forward to pull Melda off, or at least to separate them. And that's the moment when John Eastlake, standing shin-deep in the gulf, fires the harpoon pistol. The triple-bladed bit takes his oldest daughter high in the throat, and she stands, bolt upright, with 2 inches of steel poking out in front of her and 4 more jutting out behind, just below the base of her skull. John Eastlake shrieks, "Addie! No! Addie! I didn't mean to!" Addie turns toward the sound of her father's voice and actually begins to walk toward him, and that is all Nan Melda has time to see. Addie's dead husband is trying to tear itself free of her grip, but she doesn't want to let it go. She wants to end its terrible half-life, and perhaps by doing so warn off the 2 baby horrors before they can get too close. And she thinks, so far as she can think, that she can do that, because she has seen a smoldering scorch mark on the thing's pale, wet cheek and understands that her bracelet has made it. Her silver bracelet. The thing reaches for her, its wrinkled mouth yawning in what might either be fear or fury. Behind her, John Eastlake is screaming his daughter's name over and over. Melda snarls, "You done this!" And when the Emery thing seizes her, she lets it. "You and the bitch been running you," she would add. But its white hands close on her throat as they closed on poor Addie's, and she can only gurgle. Her left arm is free, however, the one with the bracelets on it, and that arm feels very powerful. She draws it back and swings it forward in a great arc, connecting with the right side of the Emery thing's head. The result is spectacular. The creature's skull caves in under the blow as if a little immersion had turned that hard cage to candy. But it's still hard, all right. One of the shards that comes poking through the mat of Emery's hair slashes her forearm deep, and blood goes pattering down into the water that surges around them. 2 shadows pass her, one on her left, one on her right. Lolo cries, "Daddy!" in her new silver voice. Tessie cries, "Daddy, help us!" The Emery thing is trying to get away from Melda now, floundering and splashing, wanting no more to do with her. Melda jabs the thumb of her powerful left hand in its right eye, feeling something cold, like toad guts under a rock, come squishing out. Then she whirls around, staggering as the rip tries to pull her feet from under her. She reaches out with her left hand and seizes Lolo by the scruff of her neck and pulls her backward. "You ain't," she grunts, and Lolo comes flailing with a cry of surprise and agony. And no cry like that ever came from no little girl's throat, Melda knows. John howls, "Melda, stop it!" He's kneeling in the last thin run of the surf with Addie before him. The harpoon's shaft juts up from her throat. "Melda, leave my girls alone!" She has no time to listen, although she spares a thought for Libet. Why has Libet not drowned the China figure, or did it not work? Has the thing Libet calls Percy stopped her somehow? Melda knows it's all too possible. Libet is powerful, but Libet is still only a child. No time to think of that. She reaches out for the other undead, for Tessie, but her right hand isn't like her left. There's no silver to guard it, and Tessie turns with a snarl and bites. Melda is aware of thin, shooting pain, but not that 2 fingers and part of a 3rd have been bitten off and now float in the water beside the pallid child. There's too much adrenaline whipping through her for that. Over the top of the hill where the bootleggers sometimes tote pallets laden with liquor, a small sickle moon rises, casting further thin radiance on this nightmare. By its light, Melda sees Tessie turn back to her father, sees Tessie hold out her arms again. "Daddy! Daddy, please help us! Nan Melda's gone crazy!" Melda doesn't think. She reaches across her body and seizes the child by hair she has washed and braided 1,000 times. John Eastlake screams, "Melda! No!" Then, as he picks up the dropped harpoon pistol and casts about on the sand near his dead daughter's body for the remaining shaft, another voice calls. This one comes from behind Melda, from the ship anchored out there on the Caldo. It says, You should never have interfered with me. Melda, still holding the Tessie thing by the hair, it fights and kicks, but she's hardly aware of it, spins clumsily in the water and sees her, standing at the rail of her ship in her cloak of red. Her hood is down, and Melda sees she is not even close to human. She is something other, something beyond human understanding. In the moonlight, her face is ghastly and full of knowing. Rising from the water, thin skeleton arms salute her. The breeze blows apart the snakes of her hair. Melda sees the third eye in Percy's forehead, sees it seeing her, and all will to resist is snuffed out in an instant. At that moment, however, the head of the bitch goddess snaps around as if she has heard something, or someone tiptoeing up behind her. She cries, "What?" And then, "No! Put that down, put it down! You can't do that!" But apparently Libet can, and has, because the shape of the thing at the ship's rail wavers, turns watery, and then becomes nothing but moonlight. The skeleton arms slither back beneath the water and are gone. The Emery thing is gone, too. Disappeared. But the twins shriek together in shared pain and desolation at their abandonment. Melda cries to the mister, "It gonna be all right!" She turns the one she's had by the hair loose. She doesn't think it will want anything to do with the living, not now, not for a while. She cries, "Libet's done it, she—" John Eastlake shrieks, "Get your hands off my daughters, you bad nigger!" And he fires the harpoon pistol for the second time. Do you see it strike home, piercing Nan Melda through? If so, the picture is complete. Ah, God, the picture is complete.